We had an amazing show planned for you this week. It had Sprint Queens and you all could have joined in. We were really excited about it. And then everything changed. A white policeman in Minneapolis knelt on the neck of a black man named George Floyd for 9 minutes and murdered him in broad daylight with the world watching. And the world reacted in an unprecedented way. And there have been protests across the world against police violence and systematic racism. So we had a rethink. Now's not the time to be laughing and making snide comments about people running in circles. Don't worry, we'll be back to that very soon. Now's the time to have a serious discussion, ask questions, confront our own biases and those of other people, and to not be defensive, and most importantly, to listen. So today, we'll have a very different Backstreet Boys and Girl. We'll be using our modest platform to discuss institutional racism in society, and more specifically in athletics. We're still the Backstreet Boys, so of course we're being joined by some very special guests.
At the Mexico Games of 68, two African-American athletes stood on the winner's podium, heads bowed, gloved hands raised in a Black Power salute. The man receiving gold was Tommy Smith, a formidable runner whose world record for the 200-metre sprint stood for 11 years. What was going through your mind when you did that? Why did you do it? Because a lot of people assume it's a militant gesture.
It was done for a reason, a social justice, brought by ignorance of man, of those who do not believe in human rights, or who wouldn't give the necessity of thought in dealing with that particular human rights. And I think it's very important. The victory stand was, you might say, a pinnacle of what I had to do, or what people had to see before they could believe that we really understood.
I am so glad that we've decided to shunt around our June schedule. Although this conversation that we're about to have, and the conversations we're going to have with our guests later on, are just a continuation of, for me, and I'm sure for you too as well, my last fortnight. Because it seems that all I am doing at the moment is reading articles and listening to podcasts and watching videos and having conversations with my friends about these global events, trying to educate myself. And sometimes it's not been easy. I've been asking, I think, a lot of very stupid questions. The events of the last fortnight have really, really opened my eyes, and I've absolutely no doubt whatsoever that the conversations we're going to have for the next hour or so will continue to do so. Has your experience been the same? Have you found that you've just been completely consumed by the Black Lives Matter movement and the George Floyd-related protests across the pond?
I mean, the very fact that we're on the Backstreet Boys having this debate and having this as an episode is kind of symptomatic of what everyone's doing now. It feels like a really big moment. I've not experienced anything like this before. And I'm very pleased that we're here doing this, being a bit serious for once, which is not like us. But it's the right moment to do that. I've spent countless hours on having conversations with very good friends of mine of all ethnicities and just saying, listen, what have we done and what can we do that's different? Explaining to people about what racism is, because I think that's a debate that has like been swept under the carpet. So I think it's a really important moment. I'm very pleased we're doing it. And if we can use this small, increasing, of course, platform to have that debate and just maybe have a few people just have a little think about preconceived things, I think we're doing the right thing this week.
I think we're also speaking through a particularly interesting lens, because athletics, we always celebrate it on this podcast because of how it is a sport that celebrates different body types, in which there is fantastic gender parity, and in which people from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds can thrive on a global stage and at a grassroots level. But I think what we're going to uncover today is that actually, if you scratch beneath the surface, and you don't really have to scratch all that hard, there are a lot of issues there. Whether those are issues within the media, issues within the organisational bodies themselves, issues with fan interactions and athlete interactions. And although, for the most part, athletics is a really wonderfully diverse space, there is a lot to talk about, and there is an awful lot that needs doing before we can feel that it is a safe, a happy and a properly diverse space.
Listen, enough about us yabbering. Let's talk to some other people.
Did you have any idea what impact it would have?
No, I didn't. I didn't do it for a necessity of religious combinations, only a realization that human rights efforts were needed all around the world to cement the power of man and not to be malignant about anything.
So our first guest is an Olympic sprinter. He's a must follow on Twitter, and his blog talking about these issues has gone viral, and it's been published in Esquire and also in Athletics Weekly. So welcome to the Backstroke Boys, Chris Lambert.
Jodie, thank you. Claire, thank you.
You're welcome. Listen, we've known you for years, and we follow you on Twitter, and we interact on Twitter all the time, but I don't think you've ever been a guest on here.
I haven't. You've seen me run. I've seen you in the stands. I've sat in the stands with you, but I haven't sat on the metaphorical couch. So it is my debut.
I also think if we've got someone who can be introduced with that trifecta of being an Olympic sprinter, appearing in Athletics Weekly and Esquire, and being a must follow on Twitter, which is such high praise.
I know, high bar. I've got to
step up now.
I didn't even say Harvard graduate.
Oh, that is a CV and a half, isn't it?
You didn't say that, but that's all right. I'll leave that written on the Twitter for anyone who does take up your invitation to follow.
So, Chris, obviously, the whole world has been protesting and talking about this issue over the last few weeks. And it's unprecedented, this kind of response. I think often in this kind of discussion, especially in the UK, it gets framed as something that is only an issue in America. Police are killing people. Racism is like, it's about the N word. It's about like this real violent kind of racism. And what you very articulately wrote in your blogs was about kind of the minutiae, the everyday racism that I'm very glad that these protests have focused on. It's about the structural kind of racism that affects people every day. So could you maybe explain a little bit about the two articles that you wrote and what kind of that structural racism is really about?
Sure. So I think the first article that I wrote, you know, I didn't write this thing as, you know, a quote unquote article. I just, I was reading some Instagram stories from friends or people I know from industry. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of my white friends and the people in the white community were saying that they didn't know how to address the problem. You know, they didn't feel that they knew enough about black communities, about black culture. They didn't know what to read. They didn't know who to quote, you know. And I guess my point on it was that I don't understand why you think you need to know those things. Now, if you want to learn more about the black community, there's no black people in your area, read a book, you know, read some articles. Google is, information is free. But you don't need to talk to black people explicitly to understand racism. And what's more, please don't tell me that you don't think racism exists unless some black dude comes up to you and says, "Hey, bro, let me tell you about how racism exists," because we all know it's out there. And you know, the point that I think is coming up a lot now is that it happens in plain sight, and it happens in plain sight, and it's enabled to do so because people turn a blind eye to it, and they turn a blind eye and say, "Oh, I don't know what my part, my role is. I don't know how to speak against it." You speak against it the same way you speak against anything else that you see going on that isn't right. But racism and the minutiae of it often don't trigger that threshold in people. You know, you're out in the street, you see someone getting attacked, you try and step in if you feel that it's safe to do so. You see someone, you know, in your workplace who you kind of know is getting done over because they're black, or is not getting paid enough, or is being disrespected. A lot of the time you'll let it slide.
Because there's a nuance, isn't there? It's like, is that really the reason? It could be something else.
Well, of course, yeah.
We all do that. We all make excuses for things and think of other reasons why it could be. And sometimes they're legitimate. But there's also this kind of pervasive kind of racism that's there.
Yeah, and I think that's... We've got to learn to call out. Distinctions. Absolutely. Those are important distinctions because what none of this conversation is about is saying, "Oh, everything that happens to me as an individual that doesn't go my way is because of the colour of my skin." No, it's not about that. It's about, in the same way that saying, you know, white privilege is a thing that exists, isn't about saying everybody who's white is richer than everybody who's black. That's not what it's about. What it's about is the factual identification of factors and systems that make it more difficult for black people to progress. And more difficult for them to be both seen and treated as equals. And, you know, as you said in your intro, we've been talking about this for as a sort of global community for a couple of weeks now. But man, this intro is as old as time. This issue, and it's something that, you know, the black that communities have had instilled and been fighting against for hundreds of years. And it's a lot of it has moved off the sort of front page and into that sort of middle pages where, oh, is it racism? Isn't it? I don't know. Is it the race card he's trying to pull? I don't know. But what that tends to do is stifle the glaring facts that allow people to then look away and say, well, I didn't really see that. It wasn't that bad. Or as you said, Jodie, well, it's not as if he was shot by the police. How bad was it really? Or, you know, why were the police interested in them in the first place? He must have done something wrong. And, you know, all of these narratives that come out when instead, let's have the conversation by acknowledging that there is institutional racism right the way throughout the country. And then we can talk about what we can do about it.
This has been an issue for centuries, as you said, Chris. So why is it that it is this incident, the murder of George Floyd, that has sparked these protests in such an unprecedented way? And why is it that now there's a real sense that we have an opportunity here to change things?
You know, I think that this is just a case that's come off the back of Ahmaud Arbery, while everybody is watching this case and people are doing memorial runs and, you know, trying to break down and process what's happened there, it, then something else comes on top of it. I think that the case with George Floyd was just so visceral, you know. It was captured with, there's no doubt. You know, you can't look at that footage and draw any other conclusion than the conclusion that everybody's drawn.
It wasn't a spur of the moment where the policeman panicked and, well, not even, but a policeman shot someone,
right.
There's often no excuse for that, but there's sometimes people do things in the spur of a moment. This was 9 minutes long. It was calculated. It was nonchalant.
It was the means and the method of it. And as you say, the police will always say, oh, well, I feared for my safety. He wasn't fearing for anything. He had his hands in his pockets.
Yeah. But also, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Everyone's been locked up for months. People aren't at work. They're available to go out and protest. We're in the middle of a Trump government as well, which has got people very riled up. We've also, with social media and, I don't know, things like podcasts and true crime, everyone's actually been seeing for the last, since Serial, I'd say, Serial podcast, the injustices in the criminal justice system. So people who before wouldn't necessarily have even thought about this have it's as a form of entertainment, kind of, but also with a form of education, that people have been really devouring. True crime is such a big thing now, and most of it is about miscarriages of justice. So there's so many things that are fed into this, and the way it spread like that, it was like Tinder. So it's a message that people were hungry to say.
Absolutely, and honestly, I think, and taking it back to your question, Claire, I think why it's picked up with so much velocity now, I don't know. I think it's going to take historians to figure that one out, and sociologists, because we haven't seen... I've never seen a global movement like this. You know, we came close to this sort of thing with the climate change when Greta Thunberg was really leading that out last year. But I've never seen movements like this where, you know, if you put the news on, in an international edition, you'll see people marching all over the planet, and not just in capital cities. You know, I saw footage from the Black Lives Matter march on the fucking Isle of Man this morning. You know what? So I have no idea really what the actual tipping point was, but I think you're right. All those factors, you know, it's not a normal world for anyone right now. You know, everybody is cooped up in their own reality. The sight of the so many levels to the injustice that was perpetrated to George Floyd, it's just enough's enough, you know, enough's enough. You know, it's a threshold that is people have been subconsciously, I think, waiting for. Anderson Cooper did an interview with Cornel West either yesterday or today. You can find it on Twitter easily, and I thought it was really emotional. I mean, but one of the points that Cornel West, who if you don't know, he's a very famous professor of African American studies in the US, and his point was, you know, he's been at this for 50 years, you know, and a lot of people have felt the injustice of it, but not felt enough of a common voice to be able to speak up and say, actually, I've suffered that. And it's reminiscent in many ways of the Me Too movement for that.
I'm wondering about the process of you putting pen to paper on both occasions, both for your blog and for Athletics Weekly, because I think we've seen a whole spectrum in people's reactions to events in the States and the history of this movement, ranging all the way from like raw emotion and fury, and people feel that very viscerally, that's very clear to see, all the way through to people who are being incredibly shrewd and calculating with this and thinking, right, okay, so what can we do to enact tangible change? What can we do on a legal level, or what can we do that is really rational and a response that's going to resonate? And I was just wondering whether when you put pen to paper, was it a really emotional response? Was it difficult to write, or was it quite cathartic? Did it flow very easily? Was it something that you found really helpful to do?
You know what? I'm honestly not entirely sure. I think even though a lot of what I wrote it on was the basis of what I was seeing, written by people I consider friends, I was just pissed off. You know, I was just tired of seeing the, I don't know how I can help, or I don't know what my place is. Your place is to acknowledge something that you gloss over on a daily basis. And you don't have to know anything that you don't know right now. You have all the knowledge in you right now to be able to do that. And you're just not finding your voice. And that's what you need to understand. Emotionally for me, it was, I started penning it on my phone, and then I got up, I was like, oh, I've got about an hour and a half before work. Let me write this thing out. And I posted it, and you go on my blog, there's three now, but you go on my blog before, and it was that letter and a line about why I hate Justin Gatlin, which, you know, Joe, you've talked about that many one. Times. So it was just, the things that have historically pissed me off to a level
Justin
where I'm
Gatlin,
right.
Structural
so, yeah,
racism.
You're right, Claire, but if thinking about it, equal evils almost, you know, let's not beat around the bush with it. But I think you're right, Claire. I think part of it is, not that I knew it at the time, but part of it was a bit of catharsis, because it's a recognition of my own, you know, as we said, no one's perfect in this. We've all done it, as you said, Jodie. My own complicity in it, you know, when I haven't spoken up when it's been perpetrated against me, when I've let little niggly bits slide because, well, I'm trying to get by, you know, and because I'm trying to progress myself. And if I kick up a song and dance about this, maybe I won't get that promotion. Maybe I won't, you know, stay in the good books. And so part of it was to acknowledge that we are all in it. You know, none of us are perfect and got ace records on this. And I think you're right, just to let it out. And the Athletics Weekly one was more, It was more how do I find the right voice to talk about it in the sport, because athletics, I don't think, you know, everybody's got their own different experiences of it, but I wouldn't say that racism is a huge problem in athletics, just given the nature of the sport, given the fact that it brings together people from different communities forcibly, even if they don't like it, right around the world. And when you're in an athletic stadium, I can say hand on heart, maybe I didn't notice, but I've never felt that there was overt racism being directed from the crowds. But Jodie, you would know more because you spend more time than I do.
It's interesting you should say that, because I do have a story. But before that, I just want to go back a little bit to talk about what you were saying about having conversations with friends. And I had to have a really difficult conversation with someone who I consider a friend. It's someone through work, but someone I deal with quite a lot. And I had to have a conversation with her on Monday, I think it was. And she said to me, I don't know what you think about that, but that policeman I think he was a sociopath. I think he was a psychopath. I don't think the killing had anything to do with race. I think he would have done the same to a white man. And there would be, I think this is the lesson that I've learned. I'm not letting those things slide now. I'm not going to say, oh, I disagree with you and change the subject, because we've all got that English thing where we don't want to make trouble. We don't want to be awkward for anybody. So, and she had a 20-minute rant from me about why she was totally wrong. And that's going to continue.
And I think
that's
something that
I've definitely decided.
Because I think
it's a positive thing.
There's two levels to the protest. And again, coming back to your question, Clement, on why it's escalated so quickly. I think one was the unbelievable outrage of the act that we all witnessed. But second was the way that when the protest started, the police really escalated it. And I think that it took it from two. So then you've got two levels. You've got one is the overt racism of the act. And then you've got people starting to question, well, why are the police in a position to brutalize citizens of whatever color in this way, in the expectation that they'll just be able to walk away and go back to work?
It's really shown how they behave to people who wouldn't normally, who didn't believe it. It is
exactly
so overt. And when there's the world's attention is on them, and they still behave in the same way.
And then you think to yourself, well, how are they behaving when the camera's not on them?
Exactly.
And this is all, and it's all mounting up now for people to say, well, maybe we should be asking more questions of what the police are doing. And in that, we're all together. And I think it's that sort of combination of, yes, this has started as a movement against racism, and it still is a movement against racism. But it's bringing in so many factors for the more general conscious of society to say, you know what, however I feel about racism, I can acknowledge that that's wrong. And whether I think that racism is as bad as, you know, black people tell me it is, police shouldn't be treating people like that. And that law shouldn't be written like that. And, you know,
being the Backstreet Boys, and being that we usually like to bring things down to a very lowbrow level, could I just give some people some real... some really easily digestible examples of the kind of thing we're talking about. I'll post these on Twitter as well. I want everyone to go and look at an article on BuzzFeed, which is it's a comparison between how Meghan Markle is treated by the press and how Kate Middleton is treated by the press. And the kind of things we're talking about that you don't necessarily notice day to day, when you see them starkly put next to each other, you can see like it's embarrassing to look at. So I'm going to post that because it's such a stark example of the way that people are spoken about and how race is 100% the reason for it. Individually, when you see the articles months apart, you might not notice it, but when you see them put together, it's so apparent. And I think it's a really stark example of the kind of thing that we're talking about.
I think that difference can also be seen really starkly away from the world of the Royals and in the world of sport. If you look at the treatment of Raheem Sterling in the media compared to some of his white teammates and contemporaries.
Yes, that was another example.
There was a wonderful, wonderful article written in the book Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud by the journalist Helen Ann Peterson about the treatment of Serena Williams by the media over the years. Because she, you know, she was such an outlier when she started her career, because you didn't see people who were quite as tall and powerful and athletic as her. But the way that is twisted is she's not actually athletic and dynamic and an incredible physical specimen. She's actually made out as being aggressive and masculine and, as a result, overly competitive and an unpleasant person to play against on the tennis court. And that's got massive racial undertones. We see it all over the place.
If you on YouTube, if you go and look at a video that Keisha from the Sugar Babes put up yesterday about what it was like being the black Sugar Babe and the amount of examples of when she's in an interview and the interviewers literally say to the two other girls, are you scared of Keisha? Does she hit you? She's like, what the fuck? No, of course I don't. But I'm the bully. In every situation, I've upset the girls, I'm the bully. And it became a thing. Keisha is the reason that everyone's leaving, because she's a bully. She's like, you wouldn't get any of the girls to say that, but it's framed in that way. It doesn't matter what they say, the framing will be that it was all my fault. And that is pervasive. You can see that time and time. Every competitor on X Factor, every black competitor, they've got an attitude, they've looked at you wrong, they're a bully. Everybody on reality TV show, it's always the same. It's the same tropes that come out time and time and time again.
These are things that happen in the workplace, right?
Yes.
These are things that there's a difference between, you know, you're really driven and you're kind of aggressive, or you really get stuff done, or you're a bully. And as you say, it's that all pervasive, it just filters through all levels of society because it's allowed to, because when it happens, people are allowed to feel okay about doing it. It's like the old quarterback trope, you know, there's no black quarterbacks because the black football players, they're not thinkers, they're doers, they're power athletes, you know, they haven't got the brain power. Mm. Like, you know, and all of these stereotypical tropes that exist literally right in front of our eyes, and we don't do anything about.
Do you think there's an element of envy in there? Do you think that when, for example, Christophe Lemaitre wins a 100 or 200 metre race and he is held up as having done something extraordinary because he's a white man who has won a sprint race, or when you see another, you know, an Emma Coburn beating the African runners at the World Championships in London, do you think there's actually quite an uncomfortable foundation to that? That we hold up white athletes who actually manage to overcome these supposed disadvantages.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I didn't put too much of that in my AW article, but I did want to touch on that because, again, it's a thing that the media does with no shame, completely unabashedly. We saw it with Matthew Bolling last year. Kid comes out running fantastic times. Good fit, you know, absolutely sensational. And someone calls him white lightning. Why does it have to come down to that level? And it's because of that old moniker, the great white hope. And the clue is literally in that title. It is, we hope that this white athlete can beat you. Because the why is deep, right? We're talking about, where does the fear of black people come from? What is it that they fear about? That line between fearing something and fetishizing, but you know what I'm trying to say. There's a line there somewhere, and we're not, you know, I'm not an object for that. You know, I'm just a man going about my business on a daily basis. I'm not there to be, you know, viewed through your filters in that way.
Like you said earlier, Chris, I do think that athletics, it is not a foot sport that is riven with racism. In the crowds, it's not. I've had one experience ever, and it was in Berlin in 2009, and Phillips had won, and somehow me and Bayer had won too many drinks as usual. We had covered in Union Jacks, and we're on the screen.
Yeah.
I think we might have been near the podium or something, and people saw us on the screen. And this guy who was a British athletics fan, and a lot of British, and this is why a lot of the British athletes know us, is because a lot of British athletics fans historically have not been that young, let's just say. And there used to be a certain kind of demographic that would attend.
Yeah, I can picture him right now. Yeah.
And yes, socks and sandals. And he said to me, "Oh, I saw you on the big screen when Phillips won. You weren't singing though, were you?" And I was like, "No." He said, "Oh, well, I suppose you're not British anyway, or you're not really British." And I was like, "No, I wasn't singing because I'm an atheist and I'm a Republican and I don't care if God saves the Queen. And that's why I wasn't singing." But that was the only thing, overtly thing I could say. My mum had a bit of a row with some people, British fans once again, in Russia at a European Cup once. Because it's just that kind of very kind of middle England kind of attitude that is not very helpful in a sport as diverse as athletics. But there's, just talking about Christophe Lemaitre and Matt Bollinger and the kind of over-the-top reaction you get to them, and they do deserve applause, of course they do.
100%.
I mean, they're phenomenal athletes, they've done great things, but it's the kind of attention they get is out of whack sometimes with what they've actually achieved. But there's lots of instances like that I find are questionable, and it's not necessarily about the structure of athletics, but it's the way that things are viewed. The negative comments made about teenage Africans' age. It's always that, well, he's not that age, he looks 30. Well, you know, people from East Africa look different than other people. You don't get the same comments about a 6'6", 17-year-old Polish shot putter not looking their age. It's things like that. It's every time people fawn over Sydney McLaughlin and not over Delina Mohammed, who's the Olympic champion and world champion and world record holder. The same, do you remember Lolo Jones?
Yeah,
like the attention Lolo Jones got when she never won anything. And Dawn Harper, who's Olympic gold and silver medalist, doesn't get even a tenth of the attention. So there's a thing I was watching, I was looking on YouTube yesterday, the Impossible Games, which is, we're recording the day before, it will come out afterwards. But it's Jakob Ingebrigtsen and the Ingebrigtsens competing in Norway, and they're up against Timothy Cheruiyot and his team. I think it's going to have Menangoy as well on the team. And it's a nice little video about this. He's coming up, it's exciting. But the headline is Jakob Ingebrigtsen's impossible world record attempt. Why would we frame it around Jakob Ingebrigtsen when he's not the world champion, he's not the world number one, and the person he's competing against is 2 seconds faster than him? But why have we framed it around him? Well, we know why. It's things like that that are not noticeable. Like every day, it's not something we don't need to march about that. It's not the same as people being killed, but it's that kind of constant drip, 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 drip of things like that that I notice because I do. But I think people don't necessarily.
We understand why the media do these things, right? It's if you look at someone like Anna Kournikova, who had a fantastic career. Yeah. And millions by not being very good, just being very good for the cameras. And you know, it's a thing. It's part and parcel. Sport is marketing. We understand that. But I think that again, all of these things are about what exists in the grey area, right? Between, you know what, fine, a little bit of that is probably a bit harmless, but you've probably taken it a bit too far there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you've probably then taken it a bit too far too consistently. And, you know, it does come out from that. Again, look, we had it with Craig Pickering and Jason Gardner, you know, back in the day. And yet there was a great subtext to it. Craig was young and upcoming. It was great to see the lifeblood because the old guard had been hanging around a long time at that stage. They were training together. That was even better. But what was really underlying it was here is a white sprinter and he's going to stick it to the old, you know, to the old black guys. What becomes so vicious about it is that it is something that's done so out in the open, like the examples you've just given, Jody. It just becomes something that is accepted and therefore, hey, let's do it. Let's get it out there. Let's eulogize about these athletes. Not because they're not talented, of course they are, but that's not why you're talking about them in the way that you are.
We're going to be speaking to Donna shortly, who I think will shed a lot of light on the organizational side of things. But Chris, you've lived it. You have been an athlete who, as you wrote in your Athletics Weekly piece, has suffered at the hands of people who not only passively allow acts of racism to take place around them, but who enact them themselves. Is there, obviously this is a big turning point, this moment that we're living in now, but do you think that in the time that you've been a competitor and a fan and someone immersed in the world of athletics, has there been positive movement? Has there been improvements? Or do you think this is so, so necessary right now because we've been stagnant for so long?
So again, to be fully honest with you, it's difficult because when I think back about athletics, you go from airport to track to hotel to track to airport. You rinse, you know, repeat. That's your cycle. And you're so focused on being, I've been to so many cities, some of them I can't even remember, some of them I remember nothing about. You're there to do a job. You go there and you do that job. And you're that focused on what it is that you're doing. You know, you don't care where you are. You don't even necessarily. Could you pick it out on a map? Maybe, maybe not. I'm not saying. I don't want to try and whitewash it and say, oh, there's no racism in athletics by saying that I didn't experience much of it. But I guess what I can say is the incidents I had around racism were earlier in my career. And if that means that maybe there was progress, maybe there was. But I never. It's as close to a meritocracy athletics as I've ever experienced in that, you know, if you're fast enough, dude, there's a lane for you. You know, generally that's how it works. And it's tough to say much further than that. So I haven't, the one thing that hasn't changed though is, you know, where are the black voices in the boardroom? And that is the consistent, constant, that somehow never seems to change, no matter what percentage of the team out there on the track and in the field is black. I'm yet to see And maybe they are there, but I'm yet to see and hear from prominent black voices in the board.
I could talk to you about this for hours. I think there's a lot that I could learn, a lot that our listeners could learn, and just a lot that I want to hear from you. But if there's one takeaway from this episode, one tangible, enactable lesson that athletics fans, let's stick to athletics because otherwise this just gets too big picture, that they could take away from this, what would you like to see people doing in the future?
It's a really good question. Because I've thought about this, and I've thought about this when you asked this earlier in the interview. Earlier in the chat, the powwow. I thought about, you know, what are the actions? Because there's so much energy around it. What are the actions that people can come? Because people want tangible action. It's like any meeting, right? You leave and you're like, okay, what do I do next? What's my deliverable?
Hmm.
What does that look like in athletics? How can you, in a way, it's harder to sort of stand up against something that is so wispy. You know, it's like, you know, it's there, but it's sort of wishy-washy. So how do you grab hold of it, pull it apart, and you know, disperse it, dispel it? I think what athletics offers people is education. It gives you the opportunity to look into the lives of a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life. And I guess, you know, making it up as I go along, but I guess part of my article was about, it's great seeing these guys out there breaking world records, but do you know what they struggle with at home? Do you know what life is like in parts of, you know, the southern US for these athletes that come out of Tennessee State or wherever it is? Do you know what life is like for the Kenyans? Do you see, you know, the expat black athletes running for Nordic countries? Do you know what life is like back home for them? And I think, you know, if there's one thing that the athletics community, who are curious people, they love their stats, they love their personalities, one thing they can do is look into those people, have a look at, you know, what you think, try and figure out what you think life might be like at home for them, and just educate yourself on what it is that the people face around the world. Because I think that there's not a deliverable, there's no one you can write to, there's no, you know, yeah, it'd be great to see black voices represented in UK athletics, but good luck with that. That's Donna's role. And Donna's superb. You know, if Donna's doing it, it will be done well. But what can each one of us do is just try and know a little bit more about what is actually happening out there, because it's the knowledge of it that stops it from being able to exist in the darkness.
And I think that's something that World Athletics could help with as well. Promoting people from different backgrounds, not just people who are English speaking, all different things. And I'm sure that coming out of this, there's going to be lots of initiatives around that, and I think we need to support them and encourage them, and really kind of keep our eye on the ball. This isn't something that is left, in 2 weeks' time we've all forgotten about.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to get out of my article, I just didn't quite know how to do it, was, you know, athletics takes us to all of these middle of nowhere places, right? And I mean that with no disrespect, but for me, coming from London, then I'm flying to Eastern Europe, this pinpoint town in the middle of no place, because they've got a track. And governing bodies can do more to not just have us be performing black people. The World Champs went to Russia, 2013, and the World Cup for football was in Russia 5 years later, saying, well, we might not actually go unless you do something about racism. Where was that noise from the IAAF, as it was then? You know, so if you want to bring us, you want to bring the commercials that we bring you, you want to bring the good viewing, you want to bring the tourists, maybe it's time to start setting in place some, you want this prestigious event in your nation, well, let's have a look at your record and the quality before we decide if we're going to make all of these black athletes leave their home and come perform for it.
And that goes for female athletes, and it goes for gay athletes as well. And the places that have taken sporting events recently.
Absolutely. And I think that's something I tried to bring out in my initial article, which was the empathy factor. Right now, we're talking about black people. We've had this conversation about women. We continue to have it. We've had this conversation about sexuality.
we continue to have it. But those conversations are at least enshrined now in the sort of national consciousness, and I think that that's where the progress comes from. But you're absolutely right. Until, you know, national bodies use their power, which is the athletes, to say, actually, we're probably not going to subject our female athletes to a place, to performing in a place where they're not allowed to drive. That's probably not a good look for us. Until they do that, then, you know, how, not all of the progress can be made bottom up. Some of it's got to be top down.
And that's exactly what we've got Donna on to speak about, because she's head of diversity at UKA. And I know she's been working very hard. And a lot of people don't know what she's, don't even know she has that role and don't know what she's been doing. So it'd be really interesting to hear from Donna.
Because the argument given at the time by your critics, despite the 36 games,
was
politics and the Olympics don't mix.
Politics mixes in everything. You flush your bathroom, you got to pay the cost. You know, it mixes in everything. So those who say that are missing the point about politics. It's not that politics is bad. It's how you handle any instantaneous action about the system, which deal with politics. Politics is good. Politics is there.
It was great having a chat with Chris. He's spoken so eloquently on the matter. But like just at the end there, we were saying, what can athletics do? Of course, we've got the perfect guest. And it wouldn't be the Backstreet Boys if we didn't have a sprint queen in the house, would it? So, Donna, are you there?
Hey, I'm here, yes. And usually when we're talking, when I was competing, I'd have lactic. So I haven't got any lactic at the moment.
Once a sprint queen, always a sprint queen in our book. That's what we say.
Love you.
And 400 is a sprint. And 6-time English schools champion at 200 metres is definitely a sprint as well.
Certainly. I 400, gone are the days where you can jog the first 200 and sprint the last 200. That definitely I had to change my mindset around that pretty quickly, and I still got it quite wrong in Sydney, but hey ho, it is what it is.
Almost. So Dom, obviously we know you as an athlete, as a 400 metre runner, sprinter, on the team for years, and team captain many times. You've been vice president of British Athletics, but you've got a role now that you've been in for 3 years that is so entwined in all the stuff we're talking about. And yet I don't think people know that this is what you do and that there is a role at British Athletics to deal with these issues. So could you just tell us a little bit about...
Yeah, definitely. So my role, it's a long one, is equality, diversity and engagement lead. That's what I was originally employed to come in and do. And it really is a double-edged sword. One was to embed our core values, which not many people know about, and also to achieve and deliver the equality standard in sport, the advanced level. UK Athletics and England Athletics achieved the intermediate level in 2013. So when I joined in 2017, the plan was to achieve that equality standard with all home countries along with UK Athletics. That didn't quite pan out. Simple reason is England Athletics and ourselves were really on it. Scottish Athletics delivered and got the advanced standard last year. Welsh Athletics weren't quite ready yet. And to be fair to Athletics Northern Ireland, they were only on the foundation level. So it was a big ask for them to catapult from that standard right to the advanced standard. So primarily that's my role, but as you know, ED&I, Equality, Diversity, Inclusion, is quite a big remit. And you're right, not many people know that I'm in post. My view really when I started the organisation, coming from EDF Energy, working with them for 20 plus years, I thought that it would be a quick win, because as you say, athletics is quite diverse, it absolutely is. But all within the organisation itself, it doesn't quite reflect the sport. And I guess that's where I come in and try and embed those things, those policies, those practices internally. And then my hope was that it would have that ripple effect externally. And I've always said achieving that wouldn't happen overnight.
So, Donna, you talk about that, these implementing these different stages. Can you give us some specific ideas of what that means in reality? Like, what kind of things are you trying to change?
So it is a big... You're probably going to need about a whole day to go through this.
But just some practical things, you know, that people can understand.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what is a starting point is around our values. The values is something around behaviours more than anything else, how we behave as an organisation and our culture. And I think that is really key, because until we establish what UK athletics culture is, it's really difficult to embed anything else. And we don't quite know what we stand for. We know we win medals and we're on the TV producing great events like we did in 2017 with the World Championships. But who are we? You know, we haven't got that identity yet. So trying to establish that can be quite difficult. But one of the big things for me was our recruitment policies and who we actually recruit from. And I'm always one to say, if you keep recruiting from the same and using the same recruitment organisations, you're going to get the same people coming into your organisation. So what we did was we made a huge step to look at all our recruitment organisations. Are they diverse? So like Women in Sport, for example, working with UK Sport and Sport England. And we also signed up with VASIDA, formerly known as Diversity Jobs, which is a specific recruitment organisation for diverse candidates. And they've been brilliant in supporting us across the piece, because, as you know, ED&I covers the 9 protected characteristics. And for me, you can't do everything at once. It's physically impossible. It's just me doing that. So I was very strategic on what protected characteristics I tackled first. And if you don't mind, women and gender was a big one. And because that's aligned with our code for sport governance, as all sports need to sign up to that and develop a diversity action plan. So one requirement is at least 30% women on boards that we have to adhere to as part of the code for sport governance. Now, for me, I had an issue with that, because I'm thinking, well, why is that not pushed out to BAME and disability? So that is part of my plan that we're looking to implement as well, once that's been agreed in terms of those targets. And probably some of your listeners will be thinking, well, why have you got targets in place? And I'm always one to say, why do we have to have targets? But if you haven't got a starting point, you have to have a purpose. And if you've put those targets in there, then you've got something to work towards. It wouldn't be an issue if we didn't have to put targets in place. You have to have a starting point. The other area I've looked at is disability. And recently we launched our first LGBT network as well. So it's been step by step in terms of the needs and the wants of our sport. And of course, now at the moment, the main topic is ethnicity. So that's the next step.
Yeah, I was going to say that obviously in this moment, that is what we're talking about. And in a sport that is team wise, is at least 50% black people, if not more. And then we look at the power structures in athletics. And I don't know exactly who works in UKA and British athletics. But from our point of view, it's you and Paula Dunn. I'm sure there's other people in the organisation, but they're not visible and they're not in positions of high positions. I couldn't even find you on the website saying what you did. So maybe I'm not very good at searching the website. But Jason's the president. You used to be the vice president, and not one other person on that committee is of any ethnicity. All representatives to World Athletics none of them are black. There's one member of the board as a non-executive member, and I can't find any information on anybody else. But head coaches, historically there's been no black people. And it's, how do you go from an organisation that at the ground level is massively diverse to at the top there is very few people, and your role is diversity? So how do you go about changing that?
You've definitely covered a couple of things there. You know, I covered off recruitment. But I'm one to say, if you don't see it, you need to see it to be it. And if we're not visible, then we're not going to be appealing to ethnic minority groups, disability groups, LGBT groups. So we need to be visible. And, you know, I'm sure I'm not talking out of turn that we need to really look at our website. Absolutely. It doesn't tell a good enough story. We know that. And that's been brought to the table.
It's really confusing as well. It's like, you've got British Athletics and UKA. I don't know the difference. I don't need to know the difference. That you can't find things, you can't find results.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that is going on in the background behind the scenes. It's been recognised. That we need to look at that, absolutely, because if I don't understand it, how on earth are our customers going to understand it? So yeah, in terms of that visibility piece, that is absolute key for me. The other thing is I mentioned Vasida already. Another reason why I signed up to them is they've got a piece of software that those who are hearing impaired or visually impaired can help them navigate through that site. So all of our jobs are directly fed onto that page. Unfortunately, our UK Athletics and British Athletics page is not accessible. So again, the ED&I umbrella covers so many different areas. But as you said, coming back to that ethnicity piece, the visibility is key. So I'm clearly not doing a good enough job about telling people about what I do and I'm there and come and talk to me and so forth. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't reflect the athletes that serve us and go out there day in, day out and train and win us medals. It absolutely doesn't. And we recognise that. We just need to peel back that whole recruitment process and go a little bit deeper. You know, if those who are coming and actually applying for the roles, whether they're from an ethnic minority or not, those who don't get those roles, and if they are from a BAME background, why are they not getting the jobs? You know, what expertise, what skills are they missing that we can help them progress moving forward? So that's definitely something on my radar.
Playing devil's advocate massively here, because this is not a viewpoint that I hold, but I was wondering if you could explain to people listening why it's so important that at senior levels, organisations like UK Athletics, British Athletics, World Athletics have a diversity of the people represented there, because there will be some people who argue that so long as you are thinking in a fair manner and trying to act in a fair manner, it doesn't matter who's on the board because the decisions being made will be fair on everybody. Can you explain why it's so important that we actually have all these demographics and ethnicities represented?
Well, if you not even looking at our sport, if you look at society, that's extremely diverse in itself. And if our organisation doesn't have that diversity of thought on the table, how on earth are we going to identify with society and the wider audience, our fans, our spectators, our staff? That whole identity is needed, and you need to understand the different cultures. And, you know, the reason why I say that is what we've got an ED&I advocate group in place made up of staff that cover all the protected characteristics. But what we've done is share personal stories, personal experiences of staff members, so people can actually understand. And as an example of that, Ramadan, you know, we've got a few people in the organisation who observe Ramadan. If people didn't know what the effects of that were, so for example, if a staff member, a colleague of mine, has been going through those weeks of going through Ramadan, coming into work feeling extremely tired, and then not being able to eat throughout the working day, and then their colleague says, "Oh, do you want a piece of cake, Donna?" You know, it's the lack of understanding. How can you support your colleagues and allow them to bring their whole selves to work if you don't understand their background and their cultures?
Has lockdown therefore made this moment in time really quite difficult? Because I imagine there are a lot of your colleagues who have questions for you and that you also yourself want to check in on. Has it been quite difficult not being able to go and speak to people about the incredibly upsetting and infuriating events taking place across the world right now?
Well, internally, like I said, we've set up the ED&I advocate group that was set up 2 years ago, made up of staff. And they're my foot soldiers. So we've created that environment that if staff members are concerned about anything, they've got a point of contact that they can go to and bring that to the table. So I've had my group coming to me and say, "Donna, this is something that we need to do." We've got two staff members who are specifically, their remit is around race, religion or belief. So as I said, we've split it up so everyone's got their own remit, what they're passionate about. It's not a tick box exercise. And I've been speaking to them on a daily basis about what they're hearing. They've got direct contact from athletes, things that are going on Twitter, how they're feeling primarily as well. So it's feeding back into me so then I have that informed view.
I wanted to ask you, but you were talking about diversity in recruitment and how you are now working with companies that can recruit more diversely. But often I think about if you wait for people to apply, they probably won't. So I wondered what the outreach was from within UKA to make sure you get those applications from people who are a more diverse workforce.
And especially from athletes, from people who've been athletes, because a lot of people in this power structure are ex-athletes. So why aren't the black athletes, are they not applying, are they not getting the jobs, what is there's something going wrong in that funnel from performance to the management structures?
Absolutely. In answer to Bayo's question, what we do get on a monthly basis from VASIDA is a breakdown of what protected characteristics are looking at our jobs. And interestingly enough, from that, it goes in peaks and troughs. It does depend on the type of role as well. But considering Birmingham is where our head office is, we get very few people from the Asian community applying for our roles. What is the reason for that? We don't even get that many spectators either from the Asian community when it's right in the centre of Birmingham. So those are the questions we need to be asking ourselves. Is it how we're advertising? Is it tone of voice? But I can't answer that question because I'm not Asian. So we need to actually be proactive and get out into those communities to understand more.
But we don't have many, if any, Asian athletes.
No, we don't. We don't. And not even coaches either. Hence why I delivered that coach project a few years back. So, that again is a big question mark, and it's not something that we can solve overnight. But we do need to engage with those communities and understand why. Otherwise, we'll be sat around the table just second guessing.
What about the recruitment from former athletes?
What we've done in terms of our coach qualification, we've got athlete to coach in place. So I look after domestic competition as well, wondering how on earth do I balance everything? I ask myself the same question. So that's one thing that we're looking at. But in terms of roles, I do think there is a disengagement. Once athletes finish their career, they're so disengaged with our sport, and that's something that we need to fix. Why is that? Why do they not want to come back in? And I'm probably one of those as well. And from my personal experience, I wanted to get as far away from athletics as possible once I retired, because you're living and breathing it all the time. You don't want to then go straight back into working within that space. But, for others, again, that's a question which actually leads on to something that we're looking to deliver over the next couple of weeks, is create a platform for athletes, coaches, our athletics family to feed into us. Let's have an open forum and understand what is going on out there.
How do you think that we as a country are doing with regards to employing in a diverse fashion and supporting athletes from lots of different ethnic backgrounds compared to other nations?
You see, Claire, for me, when I took on this role, I did say to my boss at the time, this is not a tick box exercise. And I know that a lot of organisations just do it because it's got to mean something. You've got to really do this because it matters. It makes a difference. Like I've mentioned around the diversity of thought, the creativity, the innovation that diversity brings to the table is absolutely paramount. And that will then grow in terms of from financial benefits as well. So I don't know those statistics, but I think we still have a long way to go, because I do believe that some organisations just do it as a tick box exercise and don't go that next layer down and embed it fully. And I always say that I'm trying to make myself redundant, because if everything is fine and fully embedded, they won't need me anymore.
You're right. There's absolutely no sense in attaching arbitrary numbers to something like this.
No.
Are you hopeful that we're moving in the right direction, and that can you feel that there's progress being made?
It's a long journey. I mean, for example, I was only on a 2-year contract, and I said, "You're kidding me, right? This is going to take a while, because if the way that we're working is not right and that is fully embedded, it's going to take another while to switch that round." So it's not just about me, going for it. This is what we need to do. You need that buy-in from everyone. It's everyone's responsibility to make change, not just mine because of my role. I can help lead and support, give direction, but fundamentally it is about that leadership to have that buy-in and drive that agenda.
With everything that's going on now, and obviously this is the reason we're doing this podcast, is because it's right at the forefront of everyone's mind. Do you think this moment is going to be helpful for you to get stuff done? What plans have you got in the now to make this moment count?
With the experience that I've had with ED&I, both at UK Athletics and at EDF Energy, for some reason, out of all the 9 protected characteristics, race and ethnicity is the hardest conversation to have. And I have no idea why, because it's I say it's no different. Of course it's different, but you're still having a conversation. And until you have that conversation, you can't put change in place. And as I said, I've made strategic steps. So we've looked at gender. We've relatively got that in place. We've done disability, you know, where we've got the disability confident. We're a leader in that space, which is a government-led scheme for all the work that from a Paris perspective and also what we delivered at the World Championships. Then we've done the LGBT. That's on its way now. Now, absolutely, sadly, the circumstances are not great, but this is a good platform for us to really put it on the top of the agenda to drive things forward. And, you know, I just want to make it clear, it's not just because this is the topic of conversation at the moment. This was always in my plan, but absolutely, it will hopefully show that everyone has been either directly or indirectly impacted by what's going on at the moment. And we'll feel a little bit more comfortable about talking about it.
I think you said that the hardest thing to get people to talk about is race. And I think that, especially in Britain, this is because people don't want to think they're racist. And if you bring it up, people think you're accusing them of being racist. That you're not. You're just pointing out the realities of what it is for people to live this. It's not just British. It happens across the world. But I think there are a lot of places that the racism is far more obvious. And so people can't really deny it. I think in Britain, we kind of like to brush it under the carpet. People just put their fingers in their ears, don't want to hear it. So I think what this has done well, I've really noticed it in the last week, is people are listening. Rather than immediately putting that barrier up and saying, you're not talking about me, people are actually saying, oh, hold on, maybe it's time to actually just listen to those that have experience in a way, which is why I think we're having these discussions and it seems far less confrontational than I've experienced in the past.
I totally agree with you. I think you've used a key word, listen. Listening is so important, and I've delivered several ED&I workshops, both to staff at UKA, with our officials, family as well. And what is in that is around language and terminology that people use. And quite often people don't even know they're being offensive. And it's until you have that open discussion and say, well, actually, it's okay if you're to say you're not sure what to say. Until you ask that question, you will never know. You will always be second guessing, or, you know, then it becomes, oh, I'm, you know, can I use that? Well, ask the question, how do you want to be referred to? Is it okay for me to say that you're black? Absolutely, yes. But then you may ask another person, no, I actually prefer to be said, say that I'm brown. So there's differences. Everyone is different. And that's what ED&I is about. It's about difference. Not everyone is exactly the same. And, you know, for me, that whole barrier thing, when I became chair of our BAME network at EDF Energy, the stigma around that network was, oh, it's just everyone moaning about this, stamping their feet and the arrogance and the, you know, we want this and we want that. Well, actually, no, let's try and diffuse that stigma around black people and angry. Again, that's mm-hmm. the understanding of culture. We know Africans, Caribbean people talk loud. We're animated. That doesn't mean we're going to go and steal your purse or strangle you or anything like that. Everyone is individual, and that's what you need to see people for. So it's just changing that dial and having those open, honest conversations and not be offended by it. I'd rather people say to me, Donna, you know, I'm not sure about this. Well, okay, let's have a discussion. So you understand what you say does impact me. So then next time round, you'll understand, well, actually, let me rephrase this differently so I'm not offending anyone.
So in this moment, have you got, I mean, we spoke earlier, before this interview, you said you've actually got some meetings coming up where this is going to be at the forefront of the agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I wasn't quite clear earlier. Yes, this whole situation is a topic of conversation at the moment, but it's just really key to let people know that UK Athletics are not going to be just doing these things because of what's happening now. This was always in my plan. We signed the Race at Work Charter with Business in the Community last year, back in March, which identifies five key principles and what we need to adopt and are committed to deliver. And as you know, unfortunately, our leadership was changing from all sorts over the last year. So we didn't really have the opportunity to really grab this by the horns. But it hasn't been dismissed. I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to hold the mirror up, basically, and say, what are we not doing well? But at the same time, give it to our athletics family as well to have a voice.
I think what's so important about everything that has been going on is it kind of gives people permission to bring these subjects up, because often, you know, as people of colour, we find that we don't want to be the ones causing the fuss, you know, we don't want to be that one again bringing that subject up. And it often comes down to, if there's a room full of white people and one black person, you don't want to be the one bringing up the race issue, or gay person, or woman even. You know, it happens over and over again, doesn't it? But I think in this circumstance, it's almost like everyone's been given that permission and been told, you need to stand up, you need to say something, and don't feel like you can't, or don't feel that you're going to be frowned upon for doing so. Those times have gone, you know, we can't do that anymore. We have to stand up and say something in order for things to change.
Definitely. And I really do think education is key. It's about education, because I know there are people out there who clearly are curious to understand. They're not being offensive, but you know, we just have to take that on the chin and educate as well. We have a responsibility for that as well. Explain about the culture, explain why a lot of African nations eat with their hands, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's our responsibility as well to educate.
A final question then, Donna, and one which we asked Chris. If listeners could take one thing away from this episode, both this episode of the Backstreet Boys and this episode within human history, what would you like people to learn?
What I would like people to learn is to respect difference. It's as simple as that. Respect difference and listen and learn. Ask questions, have that conversation, that open and honest conversation. Because if you hide behind what you're truly feeling, you'll never get the answers and change won't move forward.
There we go.
Donna, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been lovely to have a chat with you. Sorry it's not in happier times, although I think we can all take some positives out of the worldwide response to this, and hopefully it will lead to some change. And as soon as lockdown's over, we're meeting in the park.
Social distancing, of course, if that's still in place.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To see you back near a track very soon.
Not running, might I add.
No, God no.
Cool, thank you guys.
People could not understand. It was not about the flag. It was a chance to heighten the idea that we must eradicate stupidity called racism.
I'm really pleased we did this as an episode. It's not like us, it was something different, but I think it was just in this moment we had to say something. A big thanks for Chris and Donna for joining us. And everybody, we didn't say when we were talking to Chris, follow him on Twitter, @LambsEnglish. And also thanks to Donna. I'm really pleased to have given Donna this platform so people know what she does, that she's there to help. And hopefully going forward, this whole movement will give her a bigger profile and a bigger voice to make the changes that she really wants to implement.
What also was so encouraging was, firstly, about how passionate they both were. Mm. I feel even more determined to go out and educate myself and speak to people and carry on these conversations, but also how very actionable their wishes were for the future. We asked them each one thing that people could take away, listen to this podcast, and actually the underlying message from both of them was empathy and understanding. And I think that is something that every single Backstreet listener can go forward and enact.
So Claire, just thinking of what we've asked those people, in this moment, what would you say your biggest lesson be, or what's something that you're going to do going forward?
I think the biggest thing for me is I'm no longer going to let my fear of discomfort prevent me from speaking up when I witness small injustices. I like to think that I would always have stood up for someone if I'd seen someone being shouted at in the street, or if I'd seen someone being accosted, or I would have attempted to intervene if I'd seen actual physical violence. But I let jokes slide. I let comments go, which I shouldn't do.
Yeah, we all do.
And I think it's time that I stopped doing that and thought, you know what? Yeah, maybe that will lose me a friend. But if there's someone who thinks that sort of thing is okay, then I don't need them in my life anyway. And they need to be pulled up on these things. So for me, I'm going to be more proactive in ending the little injustices, because they add up.
I agree. And I think it is those subtle things. And I think that's the other thing I think people should try and be aware of, the subtleties. Like, it's not about overt racism. We all know what that is. We all see that all the time. But it's about the structure that's in place that keeps those little things. We can brush them under the carpet. It's bigger than race often. It's intertwined with class. It's to do with accessibility in the job market, in education. And it's about not making assumptions about people, because you need to know where they came from and what their experience has been and why people are behaving in this way, why people aren't applying for jobs. It's such a big thing. It encompasses so many things, but it comes down to those little things. And I think that's been my number one, is to recognize things and call them out in the moment. And don't be afraid to do that. And once you've done it once, and you're like, oh, I don't want to look, I don't want to cause a fuss, I don't want to make a bad energy. Once you've done it once, it will become the norm. And I'm not going to anymore. And I'm quite excited about that, actually. I'm going to have fun.
I think it's really powerful to hear you say that, because I think that there are definitely going to be some people, some white people, who wrongly feel like they're the only ones that need to change the way that they act.
No.
And I think it is a society-wide thing. And it's really exciting, like you said, and fascinating to hear that every single one of us has a duty now to go forward and be better and to do better.
And also, I think, like, it's not about calling people out and having arguments with people and everyone's racist and that. It's about just speaking to people. Like, a lot of this stuff is not intentional, but it's unintentional, or it's just thoughtless. And there's ways of having discussions with people and trying to educate people and listen, but also to listen to people as well, because it's not just like, I'm right, you're wrong. Let's talk to people. Why do you think it's okay to say that? What experience did you have that made you think that was okay? Like, I don't want this to be adversarial, because I don't think that's helpful. For me, let's try and have nice conversations with people and explain. And I think people are very open to listen right now. I hope they are anyway. It's been really interesting having this different kind of Backstreet Boys. Don't worry, we'll be back to normal very soon. We've got some fun ideas coming up, and we're doing one next week with some very special guests. Thank you very much, everybody. Now, you can join us, as always, on Twitter, at Backstreet B, on Instagram, Backstreet Boys Podcast.
I think there's a cast at the end. Bayo does the Instagram. This is so bad.
Claire, where can people find you?
I'm at Claire_G Thomas on Twitter. And actually, you know what? I never talk about my Instagram because it's private, but someone the other day did mention that they'd given me a stalk on Instagram and looked at my tagged photos and asked why there were so many collages of athletes.
And guys, as we have had a different type of episode this week, we'd really, really appreciate your comments. Speak to us on Twitter, speak to us on Instagram, because this is something that is an ongoing conversation that we want to have with all of you. So we'd love to hear from you about this as well, and about anything trivial and track related, of course. Oh, we've got some good track stuff coming up. There's some good things to discuss in the next episode. Yes. So we'll be back to regular duty soon. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.